So first of all, I appreciate you guys meeting here and being a little bit tight. When we met out there with the small recorder, the sound quality was not very good, and we still don't have our permanent system in there. And there's a we need a kind of technical expertise for setting up our temporary system in there. So for now, we're just going to meet in here so that it's more contained and we can hear the sound quality a lot better.
Okay, sounds good. So we'll call the meeting to order at 7 o'clock, and I'm Vice Chair Scott Greenberg. We'll go around the table and give our names, and that will be our roll call.
Judy Palaika.
James Bovers.
Olivia Moe.
Heather Bush.
Okay, so we have a quorum tonight. Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes of January 23rd Planning Commission?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes of the January 23rd, 2020.
Changes or discussion of those minutes? It's nice you're all on one side. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Good. Okay. Passes 5-0. Next is opportunity for public comment. And this would be on anything that's not scheduled for public hearing tonight. So are there any members of the public that would like to comment on something that's not scheduled for public hearing tonight? Okay, seeing none, we will go to approval of agenda and consent agenda. I will note there are no consent agenda items this meeting, and we would like to just swap items 5 and 6. So with that change of swapping items 5 and 6 over here, is there a motion to approve the agenda as amended?
Motion to approve the agenda as amended.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion or further changes? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? None. Okay. We are going to item number 6, and we will then go back to item number 5. So, Mike McCarty.
Okay, so in brief introduction, this is coming back to you, or back to the Planning Commission. I think many of you were not here at that time. This is a development agreement with the Bendigo Properties LLC for the Snoqualmie Valley Athletic Center. They are proposing a multi-field athletic center, and then as a second phase, constructing a building that will house sports courts, basketball courts, and or racquetball courts eventually. What that initial development agreement allowed was for them to phase the project. At the time, there was no sewer, and they wanted to get started on the project ahead of sewer on the project by just constructing the sports fields, inserting those sports fields with porta potties during the first phase until they constructed sewer as a part of the second phase. At that time, they were responsible for constructing the sewer extension from the project to the city's wastewater treatment plant. What's happened since is a utility local improvement district is in the process of forming. So that'll extend public sewer out to serve that area of town. And what the purpose of this development agreement is to recognize that, to allow them to participate in that utility local improvement district and benefit from the extension of the public sewer by contributing financially to that through the utility local improvement district. And in that way, the amendment to the development agreement before you tonight commits them to participating in that utility local improvement district. There's some other minor amendments associated with that that bump some of the phasing. There's a bridge proposal that crosses Bradbury Creek to the adjacent Meadowbrook Farm property. That the development agreement is shifting back to the second phase of the project. Also, there's a provision that for some reason should the improvements be constructed ahead of completion of the sewer line for that second phase, that they would then construct a permanent restroom to serve that. But otherwise it would rely on the construction of the sewer improvements for that phase two.
Is it Gardner?
Okay. At Gardner or Ryberry, I always get those two mixed up. It's the
one closest. It's Gardner.
Okay.
I don't know.
It's Gardner.
Gardner.
It's Gardner, okay.
Yeah.
All right. want to make sure I'm looking at the right piece today when I drove up there. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's good.
So I had a question on section 1.2 in our owner packets, which is the table. Page 2, yeah, 1.2. It says, so section 2A11, the city shall not be responsible for disposal of waste from the on-site waste system, nor shall the city accept waste from the on-site waste system. So I'm just wondering where the waste will go and who will take it.
I could probably answer that. When they came through with the project, part of it's play fields, and in a second phase, they're going to be building an indoor recreation facility, which will have showers and bathrooms. The formation of a ULID takes quite a bit of time to go through the financing portion of it, go through the design of the improvements, and then installing them over a large area where you're crossing creeks, and it's quite a large project. It's about somewhere between $7 and $8 million. So in phase two, in order for them to build that, should they choose to build the buildings and the facilities that require wastewater to be stored, the proposal was to build a large underground vault and have that pumped out so that they could, just like you would with a septic system. We're hoping, and I think the proponent is hoping, that the ULID and the timing of their second phase will be coincidental, so they can hook up the sewer and they don't have to build a vault, because it's kind of a waste of investment. But if they do that, they would use the typical disposal that a septic company would use. They'd come and pump it out and take it to wherever they have. They usually have deals with various municipal sewer plants. We didn't want that to go into our plant because of the volume that it would cause. And because when you're pumping those out, you usually will take them to a much larger facility that has more robust treatment. And we didn't want to overload our system. One of the things we have in our plant, we're doing $9 million worth of work right now, and we'll be following that with another $25 million to increase the capacity, but more so to meet the discharge requirements into the river. And those are very, very stringent, and they're very high level of removal of materials and treatment of materials. So we're really influenced by what they call infiltration and inflow, which is rainwater getting into the system. And so particularly like when we have had the kind of rain we had recently, there's a huge amount of INI inflow that gets into the system, and you don't want to overload it. So you want to keep the volumes of the wastewater material that you're disposing there lower, so you can account for that INI. So that's a long-winded way of saying that they would take that to the place where a normal vendor who pumps out your septic system would take it.
I have a 1,000-gallon underground sewage holding tank for my business. I get it pumped out every couple of months based on my volume, and they take it down to the Renton Metro Treatment Plant down in Renton. It's really pretty simple.
So public comment received. You have two comment letters that were in the packet that were received when this came before the public. The council for a public hearing, and then I'm also handing out a emailed comment that we received today from the Meadowbrook Farm Preservation Association. And this comment, it doesn't relate so much to the amendment to the development agreement as it does to kind of broader impacts that they're concerned about from the project as a whole. So those comments again aren't necessarily relevant to what's before you tonight, but we will take those comments in consideration when we're reviewing the project and processing in particular, the State Environmental Policy Act review for the project.
Probably one thing to add to the mix here that I think is particularly important when I get to the council retreat, we'll talk about this a little bit. The project that you're looking at isn't just a playfield project with some of the technical aspects involved with it. It's actually a fairly strong economic development initiative, because I worked in a city that did a project similar to this, and because of the requirement for hospitality and restaurants, because when you have these large tournaments, a lot of families come into town, and it really increases your demand for rooms, and it increases your demand for not only hotels, but for restaurants as well. And this is kind of part of the normal maturation of a community to add these sorts of events and things, and then you'll be adding your restaurants and your hotels and that sort of thing. We really have a dearth of facilities for people here. Some of the really fast-growing sports like cricket, and maybe we don't see a lot, but there's a huge demand for play fields for that, in addition to the traditional soccer, baseball, those kinds of events. There's a real need for it. When this came to the city council, we had about 12 people show up, most of them involved in active youth sports programs, and they endorsed it fairly strongly. And I think it's part of just kind of filling out the needs of our community as we grow. Certainly, we are a community that's very family-oriented. There are a lot of sports events that occur here and a lot of people who participate in that. So it does have some external benefits. We just don't talk up too much, but it's a good idea to know not only what the kinds of things that you look at in terms of impacts are that are environmental or negative, but also what are the economic impacts that it has. So I think it's an important factor to keep in mind when you're talking about deliberating over decisions on the development agreement.
So one other thing I wanted to add in terms of process is the council has already considered this matter at a public hearing. That was about a month ago. But before they made their final decision on this, they wanted to have the Planning Commission review and make a recommendation back to them. Their recommendation otherwise is to approve the development amendment to the development agreement as proposed.
I have a question as well on this. Are we ready to vote, or can I
ask? No, we've got the public hearing.
Okay.
We have to do.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to hold your question or ask it now?
I didn't know if, because we asked a question, and know where we're going around. So.
Well, we can ask questions, but I would refrain from giving opinions at this point until the public hearing. Should we open the public hearing? Okay. So public hearing is open at 7:12. Is there anybody who would like to speak to this matter?
So I can speak to it. Okay. I'm John Miller. My wife and I, Wendy, are the developers of this project. And we're very, very passionate about kids sports, number one, but also doing what's right for the community. And this has been our plan all along. We've been through this process for about 6 years now. I have been a coach in this valley for many, many years. She was 5 years old, probably. We've been in every facility from Fall City to North Bend, and it's unbelievable how substandard our facilities are for many of our sports, including basketball, for instance, where you have a quarter, and you have an elementary-sized court that has four different teams in there practicing, and they can't run back and forth. It's really unfortunate. And this is really what has spawned the idea to build a facility such as this. Obviously, you know, we're doing it as a business, but also we wanted to do something on that property that would benefit the city in general. And I couldn't have put it any better than David did earlier. It's going to bring it's going to bring visitors to our city as opposed to residents that are going to spend a lot of money for our businesses and just elevate the city in general. So we're really excited that the council finally came to that conclusion and voted in favor of it. And we hope that you guys see the benefit as well. So thank you.
Anyone else? All right. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing at 7:14. Now I'll turn it back to the commission for questions and comments. Staff. Yes. Now would be good.
Okay. I have a question on a conceptual thing. On the parking, I actually drove it today so that I could visually see where the stakes were and kind of get the lay of the land a bit. And the 14th Street on this map, we take it out, it's a rectangle for a dead compass. Is Encompass still going to remain there once they're...
That site is. I don't think that's going to be Encompass anymore once they build a new campus.
Oh, they're not going to keep that for anything else?
I don't know their plans, but anyway, that's, that building will stay.
Okay. And then the old credit union, that's bye-bye.
Right.
Okay. So then as you go down there, is there entrance to parking off of Bullock Golf Course Road?
Yes.
There is. There's a park. Does that parking lot go through?
It does. Well, yeah, if you look at page 15, Exhibit C, that shows the kind of layout.
Right.
And it doesn't go through to 202, but it goes back through to 14th Street. So an entrance off 14th Street.
So there's parking along there, and then you come in. And does it, you can't, can you get to the all those parking stalls from two different directions? One on 14th and one on Golf Course Road?
Yes. It's been a while since I got into the detailed site plan, but I think the secondary entrance off of Bolt is a one-way in only. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm just thinking of all the people coming for tournaments. So more than just one coming off of 202, going left, turning into 14th, and it can be a lot of stack up both ways. North, you know.
Well, I think the one-way coming in is meant to kind of alleviate that.
Okay.
Then, yeah, then you have the left turn conflict.
Yes, yes.
So on the left side of where it says phase two, it looks like there's a driveway on the side of the courts there. That goes through all the way to Bolt.
Yes.
Okay. It's hard to see.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's kind of a U-shaped circulation.
And on the fields fenced?
Yes, I believe they are. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Right. And is there seating, or are you just, is it bleacher type thing? Come, yeah, bring your chairs. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I have a rendering if you want to take a look at it. It's probably a little far here.
That's okay. I wasn't sure where everybody was going to back
stop. Yeah, there are bleachers. The fields you can use for four Little League baseball fields. You can transition it into a high school field. But there are bleachers on both sides, and then there are batting cages on the outside of the fence.
Thank you. That was my question with the parking mm-hmm. and how we're getting in and out.
I have a question. I was just reading this letter, and there was a point on lighting. Will there be an hour that the lights are turned off, or are they on?
That is something that we'll have to consider through the CEPA process, limitations to minimize impacts to adjacent properties, but what is the kind of overall proposal for how long you'd be operating in the evenings?
Well, candidly, we plan on having adult leagues that go later, having kids on the fields earlier in the evenings, and then as we get later in the evenings, having softball. But I can't imagine them lasting later than 10 o'clock. And I would just add that the technology and lighting has gotten so much better that it should not impact others in that area other than the fields.
So the vault will be built only if sewer is not available?
Right.
Is the way I'm understanding it? Okay. So if I know that we haven't, City Council hasn't voted on phase two of the sewer yet, so would that could potentially be plan B?
The intent, as I indicated earlier, is to try to coordinate the phase where you actually need sewer and you're not going to be using the porta potties because you've got a building and you've got showers and bathrooms. The intent is to try to coordinate that with the construction of the extension of sewer lines mm-hmm. so that they can hook up to it. It's kind of a safety net to have the vault. If they wanted to go ahead before we have the sewer lines in, then they have to have a place to contain it that meets health code, and they would be responsible for pumping that.
Okay, so we don't have to wait for phase two to be voted on to the council. This is already good to go.
Right.
Okay.
David, you mentioned health review. Would any of this necessitate a review by the King County Health District for permitting?
Yeah, all health regulations have to be met with anything they put in here, and it's a real good analogy to look at Scott's situation, because some businesses do have the need, you know, for instance, a winery, where they have to store that material and they have to pump it out. So it's not an unusual thing, and certainly we have both in the city and throughout the county use of septic systems that are serviced pretty regularly.
But the health department will have to, as far as I know, will have to approve the design, location, and operation of the facility.
So there's still, the health department has to approve that, and then there it goes through. There's a CEPA in 2016, but there's a...
That CEPA was just on the development agreement itself. Okay. The project itself will require a much more extensive CEPA, so that will likely be a mitigated determination of non-significance with conditions addressing things like lighting and parking and noise impacts and whatnot.
Any other questions or comments? Okay.
So this is up to the Planning Commission, but because the council had already made their recommendation and wanted to get your feedback, we were looking for your recommendation tonight if you're ready to do so. But if you prefer to wait and make your final recommendation at the next meeting, that's possible as well.
I'm personally uncomfortable moving ahead with this. It's an amendment. It's not approving the development agreement for the whole project. It's just this particular amendment. Anybody would like to make a motion to recommend approval of the proposed amendment? That would probably be one option. And then we can see if there's a motion in a second and go from there. That's let me get to that. It's just way back here at the beginning. Instead of motion to, I'm on page, the council packet is labeled page 58. It's at the beginning of our packet. Yeah, that recommended action for us would be motion to recommend approval of.
That's what you're looking for today.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to try it.
Okay.
You ready? The motion to approve.
Recommend.
I recommend the motion to approve AB 20-010, a resolution authorizing a First Amendment to the development agreement with Bendigo Properties, LLC, for the Snoqualmie Valley Athletic Complex.
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Passes 5-0. Great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you guys for coming out.
Thank you.
Again.
Appreciate it.
I'm sure you're welcome to see any more.
Yeah, no, I just think I'll take that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Process question, what happens if the City Council recommendation goes with the Planning Commission?
So we then bring that, this, so because they've already approved it, subject to your approval, it's done. If you guys differed, your different opinion would go back to them to reconsider.
For, you want to flip that the other way then too, for?
Ordinarily, you guys.
If it differs, they override us.
Right, they have that ability. Ordinarily, things come to you first. In this case, I don't remember the reason why, but it went to them and then with the consideration of you.
Yeah, I think generally the protocol that the council likes to see is that public hearings are held at the Planning Commission level. It's a little more relaxed and people are able to take their time. Council agendas often have a lot of material on them. And meetings go late and it's hurried and it's a little bit more interchange and discourse and discussion at the Planning Commission level.
Yeah. Okay. Back to number 5. A briefing from the council retreat, which I'm sure was extremely exciting and not asleep.
Actually,
that was yesterday, right?
Yes, it was yesterday, and I'll let Olivia chime in because she sat through the whole retreat diligently. She was quite the civic student, and I'll just kind of breeze through it because it really was pretty intense. And if y'all are interested, we can provide for you the PowerPoint that we use, which has a lot of great slides in it. And if everybody on the commission would kind of like to have that, just read the background, I'll make sure that I get it to Mike and Mike can get it out to you. It was a facilitated event, and Marilyn Beard, who is a former deputy city manager from Kirkland and really has worked in this area for about 30 years and does this professionally all over the place and did it while she was working for Kirkland. She's very, very good, and she knows how to keep everybody on task, and it's good to have a facilitator because nobody's in charge but the facilitator, so you don't have any bosses at the thing. It's pretty much a free exchange. So Marilyn helped to spearhead it. A lot of the information was put together by Mayor McFarland and our Mayor Pro Tem Elwood. And what we did is went through about six or seven different sections. The first one was a King County Economic Overview by David Reich, who's the King County Economist. Very interesting information. He's also sending us his PowerPoint. We could put that together with this other. Takeaways from that to me were that obviously we have an extremely robust commercial environment in King County, which is driven by Seattle and Bellevue. And that all the trends and arrows seem to go up, although it's kind of flattened out a little bit. The percentage of growth and the absorption of office space and that kind of thing is not as robust as it was 1 and 2 years ago. And the other interesting thing is that the housing market kind of spurted during that same period of time and flattened out more than the office market currently. It doesn't mean we don't have a need for housing, but I think in a lot of cases we're running out of room. People are pushing the densities about as far as they can go, and we're falling further and further behind on the production of housing, and that's countywide. We also know there's a huge shift from single-family housing to multifamily housing, so the mix of single-family to multifamily is changing throughout the region. So he had some very interesting information to give to us to kind of lay a platform, and toward the end of it, he segued from the county economy into the city's economy, and I had provided him with our CAI report, which is an economic profile. And from his presentation, we went into the North Bend economic profile and, you know, what some of those characteristics are there. Two big takeaways: we live off of freeway commercial. We have a higher per capita sales than does Issaquah, which is pretty surprising. And that is due to our outlet mall, gasoline, food, the things that people, you know, it's the first in, last out location for quite a distance. So that is really a powerhouse for us. And so one of the questions we posed to the council is, do you think that we should continue to capitalize on that as we don't build as many subdivisions and we're getting built out, we're headed toward a maintenance economy rather than a growth economy in terms of our population? We're going to have to stabilize at some point where we don't live off of development monies. So we have to look at how we diversify our local tax base so that we can provide services to the new people in the community and continue to have the quality of life that we do here that has to be supported by the economy. So part of it was to take a look at what are our opportunities down North Bend Way, what are our opportunities with our remaining industrial land, what are our opportunities to continue to grow our downtown. There were some questions and comments that came up with regard to issues like QFC outgrowing its site, and they're kind of interested in another one. And if the population is moving further east, is it a good idea to move a high traffic generator in a place that receives on average 3 trips a week from a household to a more central location on North Bend Way to get some of that traffic out of the downtown and provide some newer shopping experiences that people want to have and maybe not have as many storage containers to use for storage and have places where you can load and unload without the difficulties that you have in that small site that they're on. There were some concerns expressed when we talked about you know, our economic growth, about what are the opportunities that we're seeing and what incentives do we need to offer. And one big program that we're involved with now is to try to defer frontage improvements on North Bend Way, have people join into an assessment district where we build them at one time rather than piecemeal. And so there were some of those issues had kind of robust discussion. We also talked about our budget. There were a couple of interesting charts that showed where does our general fund money come from, what is the source of that revenue, and how is it expended. Take away from that, about 50% of it goes into public safety, and then the rest of it goes into other services that we provide here. And that's not unusual. That's pretty typical. I know that when I worked in Folsom in California, we had 65% of our budget going to public safety. So we went through that and took a look at what those trends are. And those trends are really headed toward a more of a stable, built-out community. And so the development income, that those fees and monies that come from development are going to taper off and start to go down. And so you want to be able to look at your tax base sources and build those up in terms of your commercial uses and develop a more robust, stable economy over time. We also had a really good presentation by Jesse Reynolds on the comprehensive plan update and the urban growth capacity studies. Every 8 years, cities and counties in the state under the Growth Management Act have to update their comprehensive plans. And the three elements of the comprehensive plan that are most impacted and usually have the most work are land use, transportation, and housing. And we all know affordable housing is a big issue, and they chatted about it a bit. But people talk about it a lot, but they don't have a real good financial solution to it. So it remains a big challenge for all of us. And we talked about the missing middle in housing. Well, people who are moving up in the housing market can't get into that starter home. And people who are retiring or getting older and don't want to maintain a large home and property need to step down into something more comfortable. So we talked about the townhouse and condominium type model as something that people want to see more of. And we talked a little bit about what you'll be talking about, smaller lot, smaller home sizes, because it's a price per square foot game. And if we can get into the market in the fours and fives, then we're at starter homes again. And so there was some discussion and support over that concept. In the urban growth capacity discussion, we looked at how much did we grow in the last 8 years? Did we meet expectations for our share of the growth we had to take? And we haven't gotten to our projections for the next 8 years, but we have gotten to the point in the analysis where we looked at how much vacant land is left. We look at where the constraints are. Some of them have critical areas or streets and other things that remove from the buildable area that you can actually put development on. And the third part of this, which will be done by December 2020, is actually to have growth projections. And it's kind of a top-down, bottom-up thing. It comes down from the state as to how much growth they see throughout the state. And they will allocate that growth to regional governments and counties where it's rural area and they have county government rather than regional government. And from that level of government, at least in King County, it'll come down from PSRC, our regional government, to say, okay, King County, here's how much development you're going to have. Pierce County, here's what you have. And then the county then allocates that per jurisdiction. At the same time, you're doing your own projections locally, and you have only so much capacity to take growth, so it's kind of a back and forth. And we end up with the allocation of growth that we anticipate that we'll have in the next 8 years, and that is incorporated in your comprehensive plan. It's represented in your land use element, and your transportation planning, and your housing element, and that is that helps you to be supported all the way up to the Department of Commerce to have it accepted and adopted, and that becomes your blueprint for the next 8 years. So we went through that process. We also had a kind of a unique thing that we've never done at a retreat before, and I worked with Bree on this because she's such a cheerleader, and she put together a Celebrate Successes slideshow that takes a look at the past couple of years and all the things that have been built, all of the new businesses, the roundabouts, some of them's capital improvements, some of it's new, like Chris Garcia's new building and the new city hall, and some of the residential projects that have built out, and Too often we are reactive because we have all of these challenges as a small city growing quickly, and we don't kind of pat ourselves on the back and look what we've done in the downtown. What about our celebrations? What about the improvements in the downtown? Just elevating the celebrations, there are more Christmas decorations. We do the trick-or-treat street, and a few years ago we didn't have that. So it's a good idea to occasionally look back and say, what are we doing right? And celebrate the successes rather than just kind of react to the challenges and feel like you're always under pressure. So I think that was a really, really good thing for the council to do. And then what we did is we talked a little bit about land use initiatives and the guiding principles that we use for those. And let's see if I can turn to that one, because it was kind of interesting to see what we thought those were and what how the council reacted to that, because there was a lot of discussion. And the way that we did each of these topical areas, the council really wanted this to be their retreat, and they didn't want a heck of a lot of staff presentations, so we tried to do it in sound bites with the fewest number of slides we could, just to prompt the discussion in certain areas and put some teaser questions out there. And also the council was asked ahead of time, what do you want to talk about at the retreat? So we took their concerns and we segregated them into each section where it seemed to be appropriate. So we would put their concerns up there and our teaser questions to kind of get the discussion going. And the guiding principles that we used for our land use initiatives were obtain fiscal sustainability in our budget and keep that in mind in our development. Concentrate on urban design and make sure we're looking like we want to look, and we keep the standards up and we have the quality of development that we want. Having appropriate land use categories, and your work is cut out there, because I think we find our overlay districts tremendously confusing and we want to clean those up, and we need to get to the missing middle and find some housing that we can get people into for starter housing. So there are a number of issues there that are right in your wheelhouse. So there's going to be a lot of work, and your work plan was shared and some of the elements of that for this next year, and they're very supportive of that. So be a lot of work in land use. We reviewed the major infrastructure projects. Those would include the roundabout work that we're doing. That would include our sewer plant. It would include work that we're doing to try to find a decent mitigation source to put more water in the river, some storm drainage, major improvements, and the schedules for each of those, and kind of what's going to happen this next year. What are you going to see built? What kind of monies are we spending? What problems are we solving? Then we looked at the issue of affordable housing, and we ended up in the same quandary that the King County Affordable Housing Task Force was in. We'd really like to see a lot more money to solve that problem, and we keep outdistancing people's ability to buy housing because it continues to get more expensive. So there weren't any really breakthroughs in that area. We also, another guiding principle in affordable housing is just to keep working on it and find solutions. In our case, building more multifamily housing is something we need to do. We're going to have a Habitat for Humanity project downtown, and that will help bring some housing in. So there are some opportunities that are coming to us. And we want a job-housing balance. That's another guiding principle. If you can live, work, and play in your community, you're not on the freeway so much, you don't waste that time and money, and we want more, not only what they're calling family wage jobs, but we want more jobs that match the incomes in our community. And we also, one of the biggest problems that we have in terms of our businesses is affordable housing for their employees. So those are some strong issues that came up within that conversation. The North Bend brand, to continue to concentrate on our brand, concentrate on the fact that we're an outdoor recreation community and we're a front door to the Cascades. And that's every staff report we write to the council, we relate to those brand principles that it reinforces. And the last one was downtown redevelopment, which is extremely important to all of us. And to keep that entertainment district and those uses vibrant, hopefully Craig Glazier will keep the kind of level of energy he has today, and we'll continue to restore those buildings and build them and keep winning those design awards that he's been winning from the historic district folks at the county. And then we went over a project list of the things that are happening right now that are exciting here that we're putting a lot of effort into. Number one is the Army National Guard project down near Trucktown. where they're looking to build a 160,000 square foot training center and a maintenance center for all their vehicles. And that training center, that 160,000 square feet of office use, will also double, and they've done this in their other locations, to bring community college classes in there and operate a community college out of the National Guard facility. They're also going to be building a large gymnasium that will be available to the rest of the community to use, and they'll be making that available for other groups, and that kind of ties into some of the discussion here tonight about not having adequate facilities for indoor sports. The Meadowbrook Sewer Ulid, which we've talked about with another project tonight. The complete streets plan combined with the deferred improvement agreement and ULID for North Bend Way. And what that consists of is we are going to the council at their next meeting next Tuesday, and they're going to consider an ordinance to allow us to apply for complete streets money. I did this in Folsom. We won a state award for our complete streets plan, and we combined with the complete streets program really is to use streets for all modes of transportation, beef up pedestrian facilities, beef up bike facilities, provide for transit, and give a lot more credence, slow that traffic down, and give more safety features and more connectivity for people to be able to get around in other ways. What that means is we're going from an old state highway to a boulevard that will eventually have a lot more curb cuts and businesses, you know, and multifamily and other uses right along the boulevard. So it's no longer going to be kind of this rural community with a lot of open area, and then you have development, and some of it's old and not that great looking, and some of it's brand new, and you kind of go, boy, this is really a potpourri of different things. Well, eventually, with our design standards and the development of that, we want it to look really, really good, and we want to have a robust pedestrian area that is well landscaped and is attractive. We want to be able to have quality architecture. We want the buildings up front and all the services in back rather than a bunch of parking out on the street. So we will combine our complete streets plan with a form-based code program, and it's a little different than your current code. It looks much more at three-dimensional urban design, not so much at just plain land uses. It's more concerned about what it looks like and how it operates in three dimension, rather than just looking at zoning and setbacks. And some critical features of that is you don't have a setback, you have a build-to line. So you don't end up with people building way back with parking and then something up front, and you have more, the front of the building is more important. The way the building relates to the street and having indoor-outdoor uses like outdoor eating or uses where you might even be able to open up the front of the building like we do over at Compass. Some things like that that really start to talk about urban design in a finer grain. And so we'll be looking at those kinds of things. And so the idea is to get the complete streets plan in place so that we know what our new right-of-way looks like and what our new face will look like before we build it. So we don't want people coming in and building frontage improvements that are typical of a highway. We would rather defer those and plan the area, lower the cost to people to get a business started so that they have, it's more economical for them, and we lower the barrier, because a lot of people are telling us, we want to build in your community, but between your impact fees and your storm drainage requirements and your frontage improvements, it's just too much money. So we came up with an idea, why don't you defer them, and like we buy a house, you buy your frontage improvements on time. So you end up with a ULIT with a fairly low percent interest rate, a lot lower than your construction would be if you had to borrow it and build it now, and you can fund it over 20 years. And it will follow the design plan after we've adopted it. So we can build large sections of that at one time and have them look finished and complete rather than having these piecemeal things where you have undergrounding of utilities here and then they pop up over here, very, very hard to do for the utility people and extremely costly. And it allows you to get common entrances and not so many curb cuts and to do some things that are just smarter planning. So that was a big one we talked about. And we're also working with the mall for outlet mall upgrades. We want to see that upgraded. We want to see a roundabout in front of it for wayfinding so you can get into the place right away, so you can sign where your downtown is so when people get off the freeway, they know you have one. and your services will be off to the other side. We'd like them to really, really make an attractive entrance and perhaps do the end cap buildings as restaurants so you can see people out there eating and it's much more attractive. We're even looking at perhaps introducing a hotel or in the middle of it, looking at other types of upgraded tenancies because we have much more disposable income here. And the Simon Company, I think, is interested in doing that, so we're going to be moving in that direction. Also, to continue to enhance our downtown and continue to see that improve. We talked about the Riverwalk and trail system enhancements that we're interested in doing. And we looked at some land use issues, talked to you about reconsidering the overlays. They're confusing and inaccurate where projects are already approved. And it says it's industrial and you've got apartments there. What's that all about? You know, it just doesn't work too well. And next steps for reconsidering a business park zoning so that we would have an upgraded area where you'd actually have business park and high tech so you could match the incomes with the jobs. We're looking at this neighborhood shopping center location, perhaps moving, looking at the missing middle housing. And those are issues that we presented to the council to say, are you in support of these things? We had a good infrastructure run through after that of all of those projects, and you'll be able to see what those are and what the timing is on them. And then finally, we had just open discussion by the council, and I've been to a couple of retreats here. I thought it was much better structured than those other retreats were. I thought that we accomplished an awful lot for one day, and it gives food for our work study sessions in the future, so we're going to be lining a number of them up around these topics here. So I thought it was really well done. We probably packed too much in, and I think the only complaint that we had from the council is they wanted more of a longer period of free-form discussion of things that were just on their mind. So likely we'll use one of our work studies to do that. So did I hit it, Olivia?
Yeah,
okay. Thank you. Any questions?
I'm exhausted.
Yeah. It was a lot. It really was a lot.
And what's funny is I think every city council retreat that I've been to, probably about as many as you have, the common complaint is the council just wants more time to talk among themselves.
That's it.
Every single no matter
it's
what you do.
Time too. I was very surprised.
Thank you, Olivia. Thank you.
It must not be. The city, your PowerPoints and what you guys did was like so fast and quick. It was minutes. And then the mm-hmm. rest was all discussion. So.
Yeah.
And the rest was 8:30 to 4:30. So I'm surprised, yeah.
But I can tell you I'm very proud of the staff. I think Jesse did a great job. I think all the hard work you've done with the commission and lining these up and having these issues organized in a work plan, they were very impressed by that. And I think all of the work that we've done in public works in particular, because that's where we are. That's where our world is right now. We're behind the eight ball in terms of getting, you know, water solutions and sewer solutions and storm drainage solutions and making sure that we can keep up with our street repairs and our traffic issues. But I do think we are making a name for ourselves as a bit of England because we have more roundabouts than anybody does. And, you know, that is such a wonderful thing because I've worked in communities where I've run public works departments where we were in charge of the transportation system. And I'll tell you, it is very, very expensive to have to wire together and time signals and move signals as you widen streets. You've got to move the controllers, you've got to buy new ones, you've got to move the mast arms back. You're taking other people's right of way. You always have delay at signals. You seldom have delay at roundabouts. It's a smart way to go. And for a small city, you can't afford a traffic engineer. You can't afford wiring them together. You can't afford the infrastructure. It's just not affordable. And if we look today and we find out what's the worst intersection in town, it's the signalized intersection. That's the one that doesn't work.
I-202?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great success, and I think it's really innovative for a small community to be that committed and to put that much money into that kind of a traffic solution and have free-flowing traffic where most communities don't. So,
can I ask a question on the downtown piece that you talked about?
Yeah.
Does the downtown core still, is it just two blocks, or are we finally seeing
isn't that good?
Yeah.
Our downtown.
That was
downtown.
That discussion came up, and I think there were a number of advocates on the council for expanding how you think of what is the downtown. Because it's not just the storefront on North Bend Way, and it's not just the two blocks. One of our biggest challenges is what do we do with the residential neighborhoods that have developed into monster houses that turn into other facilities, or the cottages that are there, and there aren't enough of them to really have neighborhood. And so how are you going to build the rest of this out? I mean, and that's where I think the forum-based codes could be helpful in terms of transitions between massing and in terms of similarity of creating nice, smaller neighborhoods. That's where your design standards really get involved. So that was an issue, that we should think bigger. Mm-hmm. We should think of the whole downtown, not just those two blocks.
Thanks. That's my thinking, but I don't want to be a long range.
It was reflected.
Yes, both were spoken into. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
All right.
We're on agenda item number 7, which is stormwater regulations. I'm going to be right back. Go ahead.
Okay. Good evening, Planning Commission members. The City of North Bend is undertaking amendments to multiple sections of the North Bend Municipal Code in order to adopt the current edition of the King County Surface Water Design Manual, which may be amended from time to time to meet federal provisions of the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. City of North Bend Municipal Code references the 2009 King County Surface Water Design Manual as the approved storm drainage manual for the city. In 2016, King County adopted the 2016 King County Surface Water Design Manual. This manual was revised as required by law to be in equivalency with the 2014 Washington State Department of Ecology Stormwater Management Manual for Western Washington. Cities had three options to meet federal stormwater regulations in Washington. Option 1, adopt the latest Department of Ecology Stormwater Manual. Option 2, adopt local county manual in equivalency to the Department of Ecology Stormwater Manual. Or option 3, create their own manual and apply for equivalency review by the state. Option 1, adopt ecology manual, and option 3, create a new manual, would require much more staff resources than we have available in North Bend. Option 2, adopting the current version of the King County Surface Water Design Manual is turnkey, requires minimal staff resources to maintain, and basically, if it were to get adopted, we can hit it and just run with it. In King County, an inventory of city stormwater manuals results in the following breakdowns. 15 cities adopt the 2012-2014 Ecology Stormwater Manual. 17 cities adopt the 2016 King County Surface Water Design Manual. 4 cities utilize custom versions of both of those manuals. 2 cities couldn't find any information on them. And only 1 city utilizes the 2009 King County Surface Water Design Manual, and that's us. Revisions to the latest edition of the King County Surface Water Design Manual and associated code updates contain some of the following elements to be made aware of. Bioretention is currently utilized for full infiltration in our subdivisions, and those are the swales that you see in front of all the lots. Under the new manual, only get a partial credit for infiltration. Developers will be required to utilize formal detention and infiltration facilities such as ponds and vaults. They can no longer just rely on those swales. Part of the reason is they don't always function as they're designed to. And King County has recognized that and they've implemented that into their latest manual. Additional measures are proposed to be implemented to protect city's drinking water supply. Specifically, no infiltration from pollution-generating impervious surfaces will be allowed within the critical aquifer recharge area, Category 1. That's really wordy. Developers will be required to utilize detention in CAR 1s to ensure that over time, and properly maintained stormwater facilities do not discharge oils, heavy metals, or other pollutants within a 12-month travel time of our drinking water source, such as the spring plant or the Centennial Well, which is located about 500 feet north of here. And finally, adoption of King County Surface Water Design Manual will bring North Bend into equivalency with state stormwater regulations and preserve and protect our natural resources, drinking water supply, public safety, and property. City staff recommends amendments to the North Bend Municipal Code related to the adoption of the current version of the King County Surface Water Design Manual. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So what I think I'll do is open the public hearing, and then we'll go to questions and comments. That sound good? Okay. So the public hearing is now open at 7:55. Is there anybody to speak to this item? Public hearing is closed at 7:55. Could have waited a bit for my clock to change.
7:56.
7:55 and 10 seconds. Okay. So now we're into Planning Commission deliberation. So do we have questions or comments for staff?
I just have a visual question. Help me in my head picture the difference between a pond and a vault.
Okay, great question. So vaults, you don't see them. They're usually under parking lots. So in, say, for example, like Walmarts or bigger Safeways, there'll actually be a concrete box that's buried underneath the parking lot that's almost the size of a retail store. And its sole purpose is to collect the runoff from the parking lot, store it, and then slowly release it at a natural rate.
Okay.
So what basically what the stormwater manual requires is any site that gets developed has to release water under forest, as if it was a forested condition. So if we didn't have that, you'd have like a rain deluge, and then water would go tearing across pavement and then cause stream damage. If it's detained and really slowly, it won't cause that downstream damage, won't cause damage to salmon habitat.
So,
yeah.
I've got a couple things.
Yes.
First of all, I think a quick question really for me is how much of, especially something like the definitions, how much of that is covered in the manual anyway?
Most of those definitions are covered in the manual.
Okay.
So basically, what we had was we had definitions in that section of code that dated back to a couple of manuals ago. And so what we did was we basically combined or compiled those definitions to match the current manual.
So my next question then is, mm-hmm. why can't we just reference the manual?
I think that is an option. I think it was part us trying to basically help developers and the development community see those definitions, because some of those definitions get brought up at every preliminary application that we get or preliminary meeting that we
sure.
get. And it's pretty helpful to say here's our code section on it, as opposed to here's an 1100 page manual, it's on page 225.
Sure.
So it just kind of helps.
Is there any issues with having a definition or a code here that is different or worded separately or some other issue with the manual that we're now referencing?
No, so the definitions that have been updated were pulled specifically out of the King County Surface Water Design
okay.
Manual.
How about the rest of the code, not just definitions?
So as far as
any is there any items in the code that I know there's parts of this from our last discussion was there's parts of this that's specific to North Bend.
Right.
In addition to what the manual says.
Right.
But is there any parts of this that, short of reading the 1100 page document, right, is there any parts of this that we're referencing in our code which would also be referenced in the manual and leaving us open to a loophole saying, reference this manual, but also our code says this extra for that same item?
Right, so there should not be any conflicts between the code and the definitions themselves. We did add provisions in there to strengthen protection of the drinking water.
Sure.
And that was specifically, those sections have to do with the infiltration within the critical aquifer recharge area. We wanted to prevent older stormwater systems that aren't maintained from leaching material down into our groundwater supply. Oftentimes, what you see with older commercial properties or multifamily sites, they're just not maintained. And being that, you know, we've got our drinking water supply right here in the middle of town, we really need to protect that, because as soon as we start showing elevated signs of heavy metals or nutrients, by that time it's almost too late.
Right.
And then if we hit a threshold, you know, it's going to be millions of dollars to and time to find a new well location, and we just don't want to do that. We really need to protect that well.
Sure. Yeah, I think the my biggest thing reading through this is I feel like, to your comment about not pushing into an 1,100 page document, the code can seem kind of daunting on top of it as it is, right? And so why not minimize it to one?
Yeah.
Right? The stormwater can to me should be able to reference certain items, especially something like definitions. Mm-hmm. And with the code being online, you should be able to link to that. You can say, click this link, goes to the King County, it goes to that section of that manual, something like that.
Right.
That would make it a lot easier for the general public to just say, okay, I'm not looking through this code, and then, like to my comment, if I'm doing something where I'm looking at this code and trying to build something, now I'm thinking, okay, well, now I'm going to go check the King County Water Manual as well to make sure there isn't this other part that I have to worry about that the city's going to hit me with later on, right? You didn't look at the manual here initially, you looked at our code, something's different, mm-hmm. right? But other than that, I think there's no reason for us to be the only ones doing the 2009. That's silly, right? We're not that special. But I don't have a problem in general, really, the idea of moving to the 16. I commend the idea of moving away from saying the 16 one specifically and saying current edition, right? That makes this a lot easier down the road.
Yeah, well, one thing I'd like to add about that is King County's already working on their next update.
Right.
So I didn't want to have to, or staff didn't want to have to bring this to you guys again in, you know, another 12 months and saying, oh, there was another update.
Right.
So
let me piggyback on something, James, that you just said, and what you just said. So this will always be, we will always be using the, quote, current edition at whatever time we're looking at this. Correct. Okay. So back to the issue with the definition. If you look at the definition of, for example, the impervious surface, mm-hmm. which we're adding to this document, that definition is consistent with the 2016 manual.
Correct.
But when King County adopts their 2021 manual, or whatever year it's going to be, let's say they change the definition of new impervious surface. Now, our definition that we've adopted specifically is now in conflict with what King County is going to adopt in the future.
That's exactly right.
That was your point.
If you move away from the definition being here,
you
don't have to worry about it being updated.
Is there something, so that's, I think, a problem.
Okay.
As time goes on, you're going to find that you're going to still be having to come back to the Planning Commission and the council to make amendments every time the manual gets changed or the manual gets amended.
Right.
Even if it's a small amendment that conflicts. And maybe that's not an issue. Maybe that's not a problem. Is there anything in the draft that addresses conflicts? So I know in some other ordinances I've seen, it says if there's a conflict between the local ordinance and the county manual, here's what rules?
So basically, the public works director has the ultimate authority to determine which standard holds.
Okay.
One of the issues that we face right now is bioinfiltration, the swales, are not contained. The design information is not within the 2019 County Surface Water Design Manual. Our code says, refers to the LID Technical Manual of Puget Sound. But in order to design it to that manual, you have to get the design information from the Department of Ecology's manual. So what ends up happening is you have 1,000-page manual, you've got an 80-page LIN technical manual, and you've got another 1,000-page DOE manual. And so if King County has recognized that bioretention is something, basically they brought it in to become concurrent with the DOE manual. But adopting the 2016 manual, you get rid of those other two manuals, so we only have one manual to review by, and developers only have one manual to design by. So yeah. It kind of helps everybody out.
Okay. And any conflicts that happen in the future will either be dealt with by the Public Works Director or through a code interpretation, or you'll just be coming back to us.
Correct. Correct. So stormwater is evolving as new technologies emerge.
Right.
So, potentially we could be coming back to you in 4 years and saying, yeah, this definition needs to be updated, or the county's ruled that bioretention can't be used at all, and so therefore we've got to strike it from our code, as well as the adoption of the manual. That is always an option, or that could always occur.
And then, of course, the other option is just simply having a one-sentence ordinance that says we're using the King County manual, period, end of story.
Yeah.
So that's another option. Okay, thank you. Any comments or questions? Sorry, I jumped in because it was timely here.
I do worry that there could be confusion without that sentence. I feel like it would cause a lot of extra work for public works staff and just the director in general to have to take on cases, mm-hmm. case by case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I kind of want to echo that if these conflicts are the public works director's discretion, how we know that she's applying these rules consistently and fairly,
I will say that from my staff background, there usually are some guardrails or some guidelines in terms of how it's interpreted. I don't know if that's the case here.
That's a pretty common phrase, though, to say in the event of a conflict, the stronger provision shall apply, or some other criteria we could look to. What other sections of code say?
Most restrictive provision. Mm-hmm. Or the one that has greater protection of the environment,
right.
Or something
right.
like that, yeah.
So that is something we could add,
mm-hmm.
potentially?
Okay.
Is that the consensus?
Yeah.
See that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I would say, I would throw out any other criteria that Public Works thinks is appropriate. Because there may be some other things that we should look at, too. In the case of a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So any kind of conflict, not just the definitions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you could, over time,
mm-hmm.
as what we're referencing changes,
mm-hmm.
you could end up with some kinds of conflicts in the document.
Okay. So your thoughts are to adding a code provision that basically states if a conflict arises, then the more stringent code provision shall apply.
More stringent or more like protective to the environment. Is that saying the same thing?
That's what I was wondering, because more stringent may not necessarily be more protective of the environment. So my recommendation is have staff take a look at that and come back with a recommendation to us about how to accomplish that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Any other comments? Questions? So the timing on this is you'll come back to us next meeting,
mm-hmm.
with the next version, hopefully final version, for us to make recommendation. Mm-hmm. So is this something then that you think would be appropriate for the consent agenda?
Yeah, we could put that on the consent, and you always have the ability, if you don't, if you're concerned or want to talk about something, to remove it from consent to bring it into discussion. And otherwise, you would just approve it with approval of the consent, the items on the consent agenda.
That makes sense, everybody? Try it. Yep. It would be the first time. I think it's probably a good candidate to try it, rather than having to get another staff presentation and have a lot more discussion. If it's warranted, if we see the changes the staff might propose and we want to pull it off and have that discussion, we can certainly do that. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're on the lighting. Mr. McCurdy.
All right. So yeah, these are just some amendments that we have to our exterior lighting standards that through the course of review of development projects over time that staff have identified as some needed amendments. So overall, what our exterior lighting standards apply to is private development sites. So we're not talking about street lighting. We're talking about lighting on parking lots, storage areas, building-mounted lighting that are on the private sites. So we've got a number of standards that call for different levels of lighting requirements, lighting minimums and maximums established on the ground, and 5 feet up above the ground, which we've always felt is totally unrelated to what is the impact that you're trying to address. So the impacts are preserve the night skies, preserve against glare to adjacent properties, and that wasn't addressing either of those things. So the only other thing that that could relate to is the concern about safety, but we felt that on a private site, an applicant should have the ability to do what they wish to do, subject to the maximum allowed. But if they want to have less than what is prescribed currently as the minimum, let's leave that to the market and not get involved in regulating that, where it becomes a lot more staff review, a lot more for the applicant to deal with. On the converse of that, there's other things that our lighting regulations currently aren't addressing that do address impacts to adjacent properties. So, for example, we require cutoff lighting for parking lots, but it doesn't say that that full cutoff certified lighting has to point straight down. So we've had applicants do that with their full cutoff lighting, and suddenly it totally, you lose the objective there. Another thing is our building mounted lighting isn't required specifically to be full cutoff straight down something right now. So that's something that we've added to strengthen that. And then another thing is light color temperature. So that's something where, especially as LED technology has evolved, the lighting has changed much more from the typical amber that it was 10 years ago to a much more blue-white light. And that blue-white light is much harsher on the eyes, so there's been many studies that have shown that, it's more disruptive to human sleep and also to a lot of animal needs, migration patterns and their own sleep and reproductive needs. So having that warmer temperature by having a maximum light color temperature helps both humans and animals in that, and it helps to reduce that perception of glare. So if you look out at our own City Hall parking lot lights here, we were thinking about that ahead of this. Right now we don't have that maximum light color temperature, but we said we're going to apply the same that we've applied with our public streets, a maximum of 3,000 Kelvin, which gives it a little, it's still white light. You can see one right here, these. But it's not that kind of ultra blue white, harsh light that you see more often. I think in Seattle they don't have that standard, and it's much, much brighter. So making that maximum light color temperature applicable to private sites, as it is with public street lights as well, will help to reduce that glare issue. Another thing that we tried to do is just clean it up, make it easier for people to read and understand, so adding some of those illustrations about, no, this is what full cutoff looks like, this is downward directed, just so it's much more easy to recognize by applicants and staff, and then it makes it much easier to say, you know, you clearly saw what this was intended to do, and you didn't comply with that. So there's no questions there. So it's just kind of a general overview. We can get into the details of it.
Any questions for Mike?
Mike, on the, I think I'm on the last page, but six of six, but it's the very last page of the packet. I think that this is actually applying to lighting standards in outdoor performance, sport, and recreation facilities.
Yeah.
So I think 18.40.080.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think we talked a little bit tonight, or just hit on the subject of the lighting that perhaps might be done at the new athletic facility.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I read it in here. Does Snoqualmie have any lighted parts?
The football field at the high school.
Other than the high school. Yeah. I'm talking about
Snoqualmie. But I talked with Snoqualmie about this when I was looking at standards, and they don't have any lighting
standards. I thought I read that in there. I thought we talked about that just briefly at the Parks Commission.
Yeah.
And when we were talking about lighting a little bit on what was maybe lit, the skateboard park is going to be lit. But it's that 50-foot in this thing, in this packet, as we go through in the outdoor, and it says something in here about 50 feet. Let me see if I can find it. 5%, that may be okay, specific. 30 minutes. There's somewhere.
There's 50 feet is in 40.050.
Yes, maybe that's it. Is that from the, for residential, between that and residential residence? Is that from, say the park is, I'm not very good, you know, you've worked with me for 5 years. Conceptually, I have to walk it, right, you know, go. But if this is the park, and where the bike track is, and the bike track is within the park, is the boundary from the bike track or the city park to the apartments that are there by the
skin? That wouldn't apply, because that's not a residential zone.
But what about those new apartments?
Yeah, those are in a commercial zone. It's in the downtown commercial zone.
Okay. So lighting of if they do any of that commercial around those new that ball field, that's not going to apply then?
Not that particular provision. There's a lot of other provisions that still apply.
Okay.
But the overall idea is if you're living in a commercial zone, then you kind of have to expect that there are higher levels of lighting. You're going to have
I think that's reasonable. I'm just saying when you add new lights, if we put 50 feet in there with this residential, that I think that's residential, even though you say it's commercial. And I'm not arguing. I'm just thinking that's somebody's home.
Yeah.
So do we look at that a little closer, or do we just leave them in that commercial district? Is that the...
So, maybe a good example is the National Garden blocks, or lot. You do have those three or four residential homes north of that.
Oh, yes. Right. Yes. So, yeah.
That's still a commercial zone. They're not a residential zone.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't be protected by the 50 feet.
They would not be protected by that, no. Because it's based on zone in that case. There are other factors that we can consider during review. So the State Environmental Policy Act, for example, gives us the authority to look at things outside of our code that are addressing impacts. So that's something that we'll consider with the lighting for the new ball fields project.
I mean, right now there really isn't a lot of residential around there. But that doesn't mean that there, as you go 202, on the other side, there couldn't be. I mean, it's a beautiful view. It's all wide open, and the LID goes through, and you know, all of a sudden, you are kind of close. And I'm just saying that down the road, it might be something we might want to look at. I thought it was interesting. I didn't realize it was 50 feet. Did not know that. So, Are they going to light the skate park when they redo it?
The intention is to just do a minor light. So you remember at the Parks Commission meeting, there was the concern about illicit activity kind of behind the skate park.
Right.
And there was an idea that if you have just one motion sensor light that would turn on, that kind of helps police patrolling right. to know, oh, there's something going on back there.
Right.
But it's not intended as to light the skate park.
Right.
Because
that was a wonderful safety idea and yeah. taking their advice, which we asked them to come to the meeting and share with us what would it be helpful. And he did. So,
yeah
that makes sense.
But otherwise, that's not intended for illumination at this point.
So there will be those lights that are
possibly at some point in the future, but at that point we'll consider it.
Okay. That's all I saw. I wasn't sure how we were treating that. Thank you.
Okay.
Anybody have any other questions? Comments or staff thought? Before we get into more, the process here is we're just discussing this tonight, asking questions, maybe giving some little bit of direction to staff, and the public hearing will be at our next meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So. Just a little bit of direction from experience, at least with the street lighting side of it. Full cutoff in dark sky is a great idea. There's a lot to be said about that, but if you do allow for a little bit of a dome, that allows you to spread light in a more linear direction for something like a pathway. Just a thought for that. If you put a dome on it, it's no longer dark sky. But a thought to allow in some kind of light bending aperture at the bottom, that sometimes helps. You know, it can skinny the let the reach out front and spread it along the side instead. Hmm. They can do some cool stuff with that, so. Just to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the direction that we've had in the past, hearing just broadly from the public, is that in particular in North Bend, the night sky is really important. So things that help to minimize night sky pollution in particular.
So, and the biggest thing, again, I'm speaking from the street light point side of view, not necessarily how the private side that you're talking about here, but on the streetlight side, it's still the way they do that with the just domed, they call it domed, but a little curve of a lens.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a dark sky fixture.
Okay.
It's just a lens on the bottom. Mm-hmm. So it does take it out of the dark sky initiative, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, they call it dark sky friendly, not dark sky approved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a way of bending that light, especially with something like this alongside a building, that can be really helpful to spread the light sideways instead. But I don't know how you would word that here to say whether or not when something's allowed.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I'm going to rely on you as a lighting expert. So if you have,
I hate lighting, but I'll try to. I'll write you something up. Yeah. I can provide something like that.
Yeah. So if you guys don't know, James works for Tanner Electric, so he's very familiar with lighting.
Not too familiar. I really don't like it, but.
Any other thoughts? I'll throw one question out for you. Back in the day, there used to be CEPTED, community or crime prevention through environmental design. Mm-hmm. Not really sure if that's still a thing, but.
It is. I studied that.
Okay. Yeah.
Masters.
Dating ourselves here.
Yeah.
It was a big thing at one point. Have you talked to police about any of this to see if there's any improvements they might want to make to our code in thinking about crime prevention?
Yeah, I could certainly offer that.
You got me thinking about that.
I could certainly offer that to them. I remember reading about the relationship of lighting to crime. And the studies that I remember reading said there is no correlation, that it doesn't matter when you light up a site more, like school sites or whatnot, it doesn't seem to actually deter crime, at least what I recall reading way back when.
There's something, I remember there was something about not creating, not using, not having lighting that creates shadows is one of the big negatives. You know, you don't want to do that, so I don't know if that would have any impact. Closing here, but it might just be worth a check.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll certainly offer it to the police to take a look at and see if they have some thoughts.
Okay. They might just want everything flood wet. I hesitated raising it because that was kind of my experience. They just wanted like bright lights everywhere.
I'm just thinking that with a full cutoff straight up and down light, you wouldn't create shadows.
Wouldn't create shadows, no.
So that's counterintuitive to what we're trying to do. They want to create shadows.
They don't want to create shadows.
Oh, okay.
I'm just trying to get it out. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Shadows were bad.
Yes. So then that's.
Things could occur in the shadows.
That's.
People can blur.
Yeah. I mean, you're not creating shadows off the objects walking through it.
Yeah.
But you are, by not wanting shadows, you are creating more lighting. Mm-hmm. Right? You're requiring more lighting along the building.
Potentially. Yeah.
To keep for there from being any dark spots.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
All right. Well, we'll bring this back for the public hearing to your next meeting.
All right. So it looks like we're at the end of our agenda. Anything else? Make sure don't have any last minute words of wisdom. Hopefully your chairperson will be back next meeting. I won't have to chair again. But in the meantime, we will adjourn the meeting at 8:25. Thank you.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
I don't
think we've traditionally done that.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Is there a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? I've done it both ways. I've seen it done both ways, or there's a motion, or there's a motion for it.